There are many ways to travel around the world, but what is so specifically glorious about the road trip? The romance of hitting the wide open road has sparked the imaginations of writers and directors since the invention of the motor car. The journeys might take longer than on a plane or a train, but in your car, restrictions are lifted. You can take wrong turns that are actually right ones, meet weird and wonderful people, and get up close and personal with your surroundings. You might have a destination in mind, or maybe you just want to see where the ride takes you. Maybe an unexpected twist in the road or the story will lead you to places you've never otherwise explored. You're listening to The Road Ahead in association with the Audi e-tron. In each episode, we'll be exploring different paths around the world across four different continents. This week,
you have to be kind and relax and have aloha spirit.
We're in Hawaii. The route, well, we'll be spending some time in Honolulu before hopping over to the island of Maui, where we'll find the Hana Highway. At 64 and a half miles long, the Hana Highway can easily be tackled in just half a day. It connects Kahului to the town of Hana and has almost 60 bridges and over 600 twists and turns. You want to take your time on this road, not just because of those hairpins, but also because of the jaw-dropping scenery.
Oh man, that looks amazing!
This verdant road traverses the north coast of Maui, meaning that among the thousands of species of flora you'll drive through, there are also fantastic ocean views and plenty of places to stop and take it all in. You'll find an abundance of waterfalls. Around every bend, water pours down the side of the hills, so make sure you pack your swimmers for a quick dip on this tropical drive.
Gosh, that ocean is roaring.
Wow.
What an amazing colour.
Aloha. So here we are in Hawaii, that volcanic archipelago in the middle of the Pacific Ocean that conjures all sorts of images of palm trees, girls in hula skirts, men in Hawaiian shirts, and a generally laid-back approach to life. Here, the weather is tropical and you can almost see it happening before your very eyes. Sudden downpours make way for technicolor rainbows and hot, hot sun before the clouds roll back from around the mountains like a beatific geography lesson. Hawaii is, of course, the 50th American state, and though you can feel the impact of the mainland on this collection of islands, it feels very much of its location as a sort of halfway house between the US and Asia. In more recent times, as this place has become more westernized, Hawaiians have fought to reclaim their culture. There's been a surge in interest in relearning the language, keeping local traditions alive, and of course, retaining that aloha spirit that truly gives this place its identity. One of these traditions is hula, and one of Hawaii's top hula dancers is Kanoi Miller. Miller was crowned Miss Hawaii in the 1970s and has been dancing since she was a teenager. She still performs at the Halekulani Hotel in Waikiki every week, and that's where my travel companion Holly Fisher caught up with her to learn about the importance of this dance.
The next number I want to speak about this wonderful mountain right here to my right, Diamond Head, or as we like to call it here in the islands, Kai Manahila.
Recently, I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a resurgence of pride in Hawaiian culture, and that happened in the late 90s. With that resurgence of pride came the teaching of Hawaiian language again, because we had pretty much lost our Hawaiian language. Then with the teaching of Hawaiian language, there became an interest in teaching some hula in schools. The word hula means to dance. It's the verb to dance. So when you're hula dancing, you're dancing the Hawaiian art of storytelling. The ancient Hawaiians did not have any written language. Everything was passed down by word of mouth and by pantomime, by hula. Whether they spoke about their genealogy, their histories, their spiritual beliefs, anything.
As we cruise down Waikiki.
The original costume of the ancient Hawaiians was really more simple. It was wrapped about the waist. A lot of the women did not have tops. They wore lei, and the lei were not flowers. It was usually shells, feathers, seeds, teeth, animal teeth, yeah. The flowers that you see today that I'm going to wear, or that you see hula dancers in Waikiki wearing, that's sort of a modern thing that came about in the 1930s. But prior to that, it was not really flowerly. It was featherly.
What changed it?
Hollywood. Hollywood changed it. Hollywood, Edith Head, and the Dorothy L'Amour sarong, the Betty Grable in Song of the Islands, and the beautiful Hollywood costuming, the glamorous Hollywood costuming changed it. And then you have the movies of the 50s and 60s like Elvis Presley and Annette Funicello. They were all fun now. I love watching them. I grew up with that. But their form of hula, or what they were trying to pass off as Hawaiian dance, is not really Hawaiian dance. I think the hula mindset, for me, happens on the drive to work. And in that drive to work, thankfully my husband's driving, and I get to daydream. But what I do is I like to look at the world around me, whether it's the scenes that I see as we drive to work, or whether I look up at the sky, or whether I watch the way the palm trees are swaying in the wind. Or these are things I kind of focus on, because that's part of our dance, is to describe things in nature that surround us. You know, hula is like telling stories of the extraordinary in the ordinary. Okay, so taking ordinary things that are like things you just look at and might not even think twice about, but then finding the extraordinary in it and developing that into your dance.
As we've learned, storytelling is an important part of Hawaiian culture, and that's not just in music, but also on Hawaiian clothes. The Hawaiian shirt is, of course, one of the most iconic pieces of national dress. Its origins have been argued by many. Some cite the Beach Boys of Hawaii as making them famous. Some think they started in Japan. Others think it was Hollywood. But one thing that can't be argued is that these shirts provide snapshots of Hawaiian life, whether depicting surfing, fishing, or drinking. One man who's been working with these shirts his whole life is local Dale Hope, who started working for his father's business, Hawaiian Style, and transformed it into Kahala, one of the leading makers of Hawaiian shirts on the island, and therefore the world. Hope has also written a book tracing the colourful history of these garments, which are also known as Aloha shirts. He talks us through some of his favourite designs and the histories they tell.
I wanted to tell you about one that's in particular, and that's this sort of blue gingham check, because it does originate from England, and then it got here in probably the 20s, and we call it palaka. And palaka was worn by the plantation workers for the people that were out cutting sugarcane and pineapple, picking pineapples, and the paniolos, the guys that worked on the cattle farms, and the stevedores that worked and unloaded the boats. And it became a very local extension of being very Hawaiian to wear a palaka shirt. And some of the old timers that I interviewed said palaka was even more aloha than the aloha shirt. And from palaka, what happened was people were first introduced to prints when they went to the tailor shops, and there was hand-printed fabric from Japan, and that was kimono fabric. And in our days here, we had hundreds of small tailors downtown. So women usually went into these shops and they bought their fabric, and they were still wearing kimonos or making things, dresses with the fabric. And the story goes that John Barrymore, the movie actor, walked into a store called Musashiya. And Mrs. Musashiya, Dolores, was there. And he said, "Hey, can you make me a shirt out of the fabric that's up there on the wall?" And she told me,
"Hey, you know the movie actor John Barrymore? You want to come in my shop, yeah? Point at the cobby grape, tell me you like one shit. So, you know, I wouldn't make them, but you know the guy down the street, the Chinese guy, the Pocky, he get all the credit, but no big deal, but I wouldn't make the first shirt."
So I sat with her, and I was like, "What? That's the holy grail of Aloha shirts. Are you kidding me?" She goes, "No big deal." So there's guys, you know, there's stories like that. There's Al Richun, who says he made the first Aloha shirt. There was another Caucasian guy, Rube Hausman, and he said pretty much the same thing. He went down to these little tailor shops. He bought a lot of fabric. He went to a shirt contractor. He got shirts made. He gave them to the Beach Boys, and they went out to eat, and then they went down to this bar that was in downtown Honolulu called the Raskeller Bar. And that's where Bing Crosby played music when he came here to make the movie Waikiki Wedding. And Gabby Pahinui, one of Hawaii's legends in the music industry, that's where he was playing music. That's where all these guys would go play music. And that shirt I read in a newspaper article in the 50s was credited as being the first Aloha shirt, and actually called the Raskeller shirt, because these rowdy guys would go down there and have so much fun wearing shirts that nobody had ever seen before. So it kind of started in the mid-30s.
And you wrote this book about the Aloha shirt, and I wondered how much it revealed about these shirts that you didn't already know, perhaps.
Geez, that's a really great question. But when I set out to do the book in 2000, I took a year off from my job, is what I told them. And I kind of figured, well, you know, professors go on sabbaticals and all these people do, and so why not? I've been working in that, in my own company that I'd sold, and I'd been working there for so long that I just thought, well, it's time to really do something. And I embarked on trying to tell the story of all the people that were involved in the garment industry from the very beginning. And I really, because I'd grown up in a factory, I thought that every aspect of the Aloha shirt was important. You know, the artist that created the art was important. The cutters that cut the fabric was important. The sewers were important. The gal that put the buttons on was important. The textile designers, whether they have been from Honolulu, Hawaii, California, or a lot of the designs were done in Japan. All of those stories to me were very important. And, you know, it got all the way down to, I took the time to tell the story of the coconut button. Where did the coconut button come from? Who made them? And my dad had a coconut button card in his desk for years. And I had that card, and it had an address on it and a name, John A. Oya. So I ended up going out there one day and looked at what used to be a factory there for woodworks, and it was an empty lot with cars. So I went next door, asked the people there, hey, whatever happened to the people that made the coconut buttons? And he kind of looked at me, and long story, but I ended up going the next block over and going into the very back of the little driveway there, and he said, well, you might find the guy. So I went back there and I found the guy, and he was taking a nap on a leather car seat. And I said, hey, hi, you know, I'm trying to find the guys that made the coconut buttons. And they looked at each other, and the guy said, that's me. So he was 78, his name was Ernest Oya, and his dad was John A. Oya, and he was the guy that made all these buttons back in the early days. And he told me all the stories about coconut buttons. It was priceless.
It's quite amazing. I mean, these shirts, they're not just something to wear, but they're also each one of them is kind of a piece of history as well then.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we were all here to see this shirt. I found this shirt in Japan when we were actually there to present our Japanese version of the Aloha shirt book. And I went into a vintage store there, and I looked up and I saw this shirt. So we got a bamboo pole and we brought it down, and I started looking at it, and it was just so amazing. It's on kabi crepe. Kabi means pebble. Pebble's sort of surfaced texture. And it's on the Japanese fabric. It was hand printed. And it's got the most gorgeous label I've ever seen. Waikiki shirts. And it's got a gal in a woolen bathing suit surfing a very long board on a wave off of Waikiki. It's a label I'd never seen. And then the motifs, we've got little huts, we've got coconut trees, we've got guys climbing the coconut trees, we've got surfers in the print wearing woolen bathing suits, which was very popular back in the 20s, and we've got guys in little outrigger canoes, again, in their woolen bathing suits, And we've got the only two hotels that were in Waikiki, the Moana, which was built in 1901, and the Royal Hawaiian Hotel, which was built in 1927. And the pier coming off the Moana, which broke down in a storm so many years ago, and that they are all on the shirt, only surrounded by coconut trees. Today, they're surrounded by buildings and condos and hotels and office buildings and towers. So it's just a classic shirt. I look at it by, if we do wear our Hawaiian shirts here, it's sort of a confirmation and expression of our love and passion for these wonderful islands and our lifestyle that we are so lucky to have and live with. So to me, it's an extension for my heartfelt love for these islands.
Almost halfway point, overlooking Kalolua Point, having just had a swim at Haepuena Falls. Excuse the mispronunciation, Hawaiians out there. You must be used to it by now. What no one is used to is the beauty of this thing. You might be able to hear the lapping of the waves, sometimes crashing in the background, as the forest, thick as anything, comes straight down to the shoreline. And we look out across something that strangely looks like it could be a stormy day on Lake Como. What road trip isn't complete without a bit of music? And what instrument sums up Hawaii better than the ukulele? The instrument was introduced by Portuguese immigrants to these islands in the 19th century. Now the Kamaka family in Honolulu are probably the most well-known makers. Started by Samuel Kamaka, it's now run by his grandson Chris, who also happens to be a Grammy-nominated musician, a small fact he almost glossed over when we met him. Chris oversees production in their small factory in the back of their downtown shop. Here, they make ukuleles for customers all over the world, including some of the biggest stars of the uke, such as the local Jake Shimabukuro, who happened to swing by while we were visiting. That's the beauty of these journeys. You might just bump into the Jimi Hendrix of the ukulele, and he might just play you a song.
Aloha, my name is Jake Shimabukuro. I'm an ukulele player from Honolulu, Hawaii, and I've been playing kamaka since I was 4 years old, and we're at the Kamaka Factory right now in Honolulu, and yeah, they were the family that that first started manufacturing ukuleles, I mean, over 100 years ago, and they're just the best, the greatest instrument makers of all time, so thank you.
My name is Chris Kamaka, and I am a third generation here at our family business, Kamaka Ukuleles. We've been building instruments. This year makes 102 years.
We talked downstairs in the workshop, in the factory, about the manufacture of these things and the grading of them and the graining of them and all the different things that add up to it. But what about the cultural side of it, Chris? What do ukulele mean to Hawaiians? It's part of the Hawaiian culture that's so like that is such a vibrant culture that so many people recognize all over the world. Ukulele is so much part of that. I mean, obviously, you're right at the forefront of making these things. What does it mean? Is there one in everyone's house, a ukulele?
For us, growing up, it was always around, you know, and my aunts and uncles were all musicians, and my grandfather himself, a musician, so, you know, the making of guitars was very fascinating to him, and the ukulele kind of was an offshoot of that for him. He started, you know, back in the 1916 in his garage, was just making it for family, and eventually it blossomed to where he started his first factory over on King Street, and then from there eventually here where we are today at 550 South Street. Unfortunately for me, I never had the chance to meet my grandfather, but my dad slowly kind of taught us what to look for and what to listen for and just watch and learn while he was building, along with the other employees, as I told you about earlier. You know, just growing up with them and eventually getting to feel that passion and be a part of it was really important and exciting for me.
The sort of Hawaiian songbook, the nature of driving around Honolulu and Maui for a few days has taught us that tuning in the radio station, half of the music is Hawaiian. It sounds to my ear like traditional music, updated traditional music. So that there's something very strong about that culture, and it's centered around the ukulele and obviously the voice. I wonder why you think it's so solid, that culture, and actually quite unchanged.
It's always been a mainstay because it's a soothing instrument. And it's, like I said, it's not hard to play, and people can take it with them. And it's just really soothing to play. Like for me, I play it every day. Maybe sometimes I kind of take it for granted. But for me, just checking each instrument is really soothing for me.
How do you check it? Do you play some chords? Do you play something new, something old?
Maybe sing a little song or something, but just kind of get the feel, make sure the action, the height of the strings is correct, make sure as far as structurally everything looks good. As I said earlier, by the time it gets to me, it's pretty close, you know, unless somebody was to miss something, you know, the finish, or mainly the playability, getting the action correct. And so, you know, when you're playing it, it doesn't hurt. You want to play it, so you want to keep playing it. You know, it's comfortable.
When we walked into your shop at the front, Chris, we saw some of the different ones you've got in a glass box. There's the cigar box model. There's the standard model. I was looking at the sort of family tree of some of your designs. One's called Otasan. There's the long neck. There's a tenor. Some of them, obviously, the tenor is a musical grade. What about the other ones? Are they different? Are they just different designs for aesthetic reasons, or they all make different sounds?
Yeah. My grandfather actually started with the pineapple shape. Pineapple, then the figure eight is our standard shape. We have a soprano, alto, tenor, and then the baritone, which is our biggest. So as you get bigger, you get a little more sound, a little deeper tone as it gets bigger. Then we have variations off those sizes, like the six-string tenor, eight-string tenor. Those are basically tuned the same way, just octaves on different strings or unison. It's kind of like a 12-string guitar.
So that's the fancy one. That's when you need your George Harrison.
Yeah, in fact, George, yeah, he did have the six-string.
Of course he did.
That's right.
And let's go back to the testing, because I'm intrigued by this. And I like the idea of you maybe sitting here or somewhere on your premises here in Honolulu testing these things out. What are the favorite songs that you would use to test out a ukulele that come in and was going out and being repaired, or indeed a brand new one that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, I just strum some basic Hawaiian songs that I enjoy, like maybe one from my hometown, or even one that my dad used to sing all the time, a good little lullaby. Even a favorite drinking song of King Kalakaua's, which my dad used to enjoy singing too. Kind of strum along with it.
Kiss me, my darling, honika uala ea. Oh, cold chance, a honike ea. Au he, a valeana oe eka ipo laua ela ea. Down by the puna vai with me. Koni au, koni.
vai koni au ika vai hu e hu ika vai ali i o ke ki ni la olu hai kana hona o kalai olu hai kana hona o kalai
yes. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Now it's lunchtime. Aside from the abundance of fresh coconuts and fruit for sale along the highway as we make our way across Maui, the food on offer in Hawaii seems to be a hybrid of American and Japanese styles. This results in dishes like poke that have now made their own trip to the trendier restaurants across the world. But to get an insight into what traditional Hawaiian food really consists of, we meet local food writer Martha Cheng, who took us out for lunch at Helena's, a Hawaiian canteen that's a local institution in Honolulu.
Sorry.
Hi. Hi.
Hello, good, thank you.
Good.
Martha, we just had a delicious meal here at Helena's Hawaiian food. It lives up to its name, that's exactly what it is. Some people won't know what that is, though, because this is obviously traditional stuff. This is kind of going back into some of the mists of time with Hawaiian food. Tell us maybe some of the things we've just eaten, the derivation of some of these things.
So we had poi, which was a staple of the native Hawaiian diet, and a lot of people do still eat it now. Kind of, it's starchy, it's mashed taro, thinned down. We also had the pipikaula, which Helena's is super famous for because they take short ribs and they hang them over the stove so they dry out a little bit and then they fry them. That is definitely a derivation that was kind of the influence of when cowboys came over to manage the wild cattle populations, and they made beef jerky out of the wild cattle. We had chicken long rice, which was also an influence from the Chinese, and then the kula pig is traditionally it's a whole pig that's buried in an emu or a pit, underground pit, and cooked, and so it's kind of like until it all falls off of the bone and it's shredded. The haupia.
Yeah.
The haupia, which is kind of like a coconut pudding or jello for dessert.
And the idea, the name of Hawaiian food might strike most people as kind of people will be able to name poke. Maybe there's a poke restaurant on their street. It's obviously very much a kind of food stuff in fashion right now. But you've written about food. You've obviously got an interest in food, tracing it back to its roots, to its ancestry, kind of tracing these things as you just talked us through some of the Hawaiian dishes. What was the food like when you first moved here a decade or so ago? I mean, kind of the standard quality of stuff. And also Honolulu's understanding of its own cuisine.
I think a lot of these places started around the 50s when Hawaii was just trying to build an identity because it had all these immigrants from all these different countries that were brought in as laborers on the sugar plantations. So you had the Japanese, Chinese, Portuguese, Filipinos, and it's kind of all just melded into this cuisine. And so Helen, who actually started Helena's, is Chinese, but she added an A to the end of her name because of to make it sound more Hawaiian, quote Hawaiian. But I think it was also at that time when she started it, like this kind of food wasn't, no one really ate it out in a restaurant because they didn't think it was worth making, kind of, you know, it wasn't worth making a restaurant around it. That was the reason why she did it, because she started out with like other items on her menu, like Chinese things, American things, but there's already so much of that, but no one was really doing Hawaiian food. And so fast forward like 70 years later, like people are really embracing now, not just embracing the traditions and the culture of the native Hawaiians, but also, and not just in food, but also like in design and in the celestial navigation for the Hokulea. There's like this really a resurgence in pride.
What sort of tree is this?
An old one. I have no idea.
And here we are, sheltering from the rain. Can you hear the rain? This moody weather that keeps passing through down to the sort of eastern tip of Maui has caught us out a few times, and we've sheltered on the edge of the highway outside of Hana, underneath the biggest, oldest tree we could possibly find. And you know what? That tree's leaking.
What an amazing spot.
Yeah. Incredible.
Wow, these islands have a bounty of beauty and a rich story to tell, as we've discovered on this trip. But how does this inspire the local creatives? We met the graphic designer Matthew Tapia and the painter Peggy Hopper.
I grew up between Kailua, Pearl City, and Honolulu, and there's just a lot of different looks, you know, inspired by mom and pop shops, people who were just writing their own signs, really polished brass signs for these really expensive hotels. And you get this really eclectic mix of the hand homemade, the overtly tropical to kind of really, you know, get the tourist look. And then just solid design of the era, you know. I was born in 1980, so it was coming out of the 1970s look, was still really strong when the hotels that were around when I grew up were all built. You know, there's a lot of graphic designers that are going back to that era and reaching back. There's always amazing things to be found in the past, especially here in Hawaii. It has a rich history of visuals. There's something that's really interesting to me lately that's been happening is you're starting to get this resurgence of Native Hawaiian design. And I know a bunch of really great Native Hawaiian designers that are really trying to bring the culture and the design together. And while I'm not exactly part of that conversation, I grew up here. So it's just as much a part of what I know of history as it is for them of their history. And I really love the way that like a place can come to define a look in that way as well, not just commercially, but also from a cultural standpoint. I think that it's amazing to see Native Hawaiian designers and just this focus on the visuals that existed here, you know, pre-colonial, and really trying to find a way to bring that into the modern era. That's amazing. I mean, and it's beautiful. Like, you know, you're seeing more and more of the tapa patterns, you're seeing more and more of the Hawaiian tattoo patterns, but taken out of context and repurposed for today. And it's really amazing and beautiful. I mean, if it's something that I end up having the opportunity to be a part of through one project or another, that'd be great. But if not, it's still great to see happen.
I introduce myself, Peggy Hopper.
Peggy, we're dealing in generalities in certain respects on this road trip. And I wanted to know, first of all, what you can see out of your studio window, whether it makes any difference to what you paint.
Oh, absolutely. But it's not just out my studio window. It's when I parked at a stop sign or, you know, when I look over and there next to me in a car is a, you know, beautiful Hawaiian person. And or you look up at the sky and you see, oh, God, we've got the most beautiful skies and clouds. It's everywhere. It's not just in my studio, out my studio window. It's everywhere. I do love beauty. I mean, the world needs beauty, for God's sakes, right now, more than anything else. And music, and music. Beauty and music. Listen, all you have to do is look up. When I take a walk in the afternoon, and it's just as the sun is setting, and I live high on the Pacific Heights over there, just look up. I mean, you're just transported. I mean, everything I do is kind of simplified. I like that too. So to try to catch the essence, you know Georgia O'Keeffe. She did a whole row of mountains in the desert, and yet everything is simplified. She didn't pick up every little rock and every little tree and every little shadow, and she saw it in a beautifully designed, simplified way. And that's what I like, is the simplification and to catch the essence.
So, Hawaii. It's happily not the easiest place to get to on Earth, but all that luscious beauty and all that Hawaiian pride makes it well worth the visit. You won't drive a more verdant road than the Hana Highway, splashed all the while by waterfalls and wonder. But Maui's a bewitching place. Take another road and you'll scale the Haleakala volcano and find yourself in a moonscape at 10,000 feet. We drove past surf and surfers and a sea of turtles that warmed our hearts. At Maui Airport, you'll find a vending machine that dispenses lei, those flower garlands oh so famous. Take one for you and one for your ride and head to the lushness of this extraordinary road. And while that brings us to the end of our Hawaiian adventure, it's time to start another. Every week on The Road Ahead, we'll be finishing our program with a piece of original fiction written by Lawrence Osborne. Osborne is the author of The Forgiven, The Ballad of a Small Player, Hunters in the Dark, and Beautiful Animals. And for us, he's written this. Let's hear the first installment. You can hear the next installment of Double X by Lawrence Osborne on the next episode of The Road Ahead, when we'll also be driving the garden route through South Africa. The Road Ahead is made in association with the Audi e-tron. The series producer is Holly Fisher and the executive producer is Tom Edwards. This episode was produced and edited by Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. And until next time, mahalo.